In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yes, indeed. Let's us talk movies. It's lobby. Monday, and that means Alan Adams of The Main Edge joins us. Hello there, Al.
Hello there, sir. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you this Monday afternoon?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. Doing pretty well.
Saw your bride and your pup briefly yesterday, but I did not see you with them.
That's right. They mentioned that they had spotted you. Yeah, no, I was at a disc golf tournament at Hidden Acres in Old Town. Of course, I'd never played before. Got out there. When it started, it was a little chilly, little damp. But tell you what, man, by noontime, she had cleared right up, and it turned into really a pretty nice day.
Nice. How did you play?
Okay. I had a pretty solid first round, and then the second round got to the back nine, and I kind of fell apart because, I'm old, Rich.
Oh, please. Please.
And I get tired. But I will say I woke up this morning considerably less achy than last time out. So I figure by the time I get to the end of this thing, I might actually be able to go through one of these things without feeling, terrible the next day. So fingers crossed.
Nice. Now, this is part of the tour that you told us about a few weeks ago.
Yeah, the Northern Maine Disc Golf Tour. Next week, I believe, is at, the place is called Legacy Farms, which is in Winterport, which is another course that's in the vicinity that I have not yet played. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, that's awesome. Well, let's talk movies. You also, amongst all those other pursuits, managed to watch a few movies this weekend. Where should we start?
I did. Let's start with a little movie called The Last Rite, R-I-G-H-T. It was a film I hadn't heard a lot about, but I figured, sometimes it's nice to try to just take a swing at some of these smaller films when the opportunity presents itself, because you never know. You might find a little gem, and in a lot of ways, that this movie kind of is one of those. It's a movie by the Irish filmmaker Aoife Creahan, written and directed. And it's this very sweet, small, kind of weird movie it boils down to this. A guy is flying home to Ireland for a funeral, sits next to a stranger. Said stranger passes away during the flight, but at some point has named his seatmate as his next of kin. And so that sends into motion a number of hijinks, I think is the technical term. It's funny, but it has some very very poignant moments, and it's just packed with a bunch of really wonderful vista views of the Irish countryside, which I don't know if you've heard, beautiful.
So I'm told. Yes.
Yep. So you've got a guy. His name's Daniel Murphy, played by Michael Huseman. He's flying to Ireland. He lives in New York. He's a tax attorney. He's flying to Ireland to attend his mom's affairs following her passing. He's on the verge of making partners, so his grief is sort of interwoven with all the stress of needing to make sure certain things are done ahead of the Christmas holiday, which is just a few days away. So he's sitting next to this congenial, sort of older Irish fella who's heading back to Ireland himself for the funeral of his long estranged brother. And Daniel's sitting there, he's like, wow, this guy's telling me a lot about himself and about his life, but, whatever. He settles in for the long trip. But when they get there, it's very complicated because, his seatmate has passed away. Complicating things further is the fact that this man, for reasons known only to himself, has named Daniel as his next of kin, which, as you might imagine, leads to a little confusion at the airport. But he makes clear that he's no relation to the deceased and finally makes his way to his mom's house. That's where he meets up with his mom's former lawyer and turned boyfriend, Frank, played by Michael McEllerton. And he also encounters his much younger brother, Louis, played by Samuel Bottomley. Now, Louis is, I guess you'd call him a high-functioning autistic, but he's very much struggling with the changes that have come with the death of his mom. And so he's really lashing out and really struggling to figure out what to make of all this. He's struggling so much that at the memorial service, he winds up fleeing into the back, where he meets a young lady named Mary, played by Niamh Algar, who is the sister of one of the local embalmers. When it turns out that Daniel, this guy who's passed away, he's going to be buried in an unmarked grave far from his brother's resting place. So Daniel decides, you know what? I'm going to do something about it. Well, with a little help from his brother and as well as some urging from the very patient and clearly on set for only a couple of days, Father Riley, played by Brian Cox, who, again, he's in like three scenes and two of them are like just him like on the phone. So it's like, okay, so you had Brian Cox for like 2 days and you made the mess of it. But so Daniel and Louis wind up teaming with this woman, Mary, to make the journey to Northern Ireland with this coffin in tow. However, there are authorities, specifically Detective Donald Crowley, played by Colm Meaney, because it's an Irish movie, and you can't make an Irish movie without Colm Meaney in it. He believes that there are laws being broken, and he's trying to stop them before they cause what he insists on referring to as an international incident. So we journey across the beautiful Irish countryside. There's a romantic spark between Daniel and Mary. He also gets a chance to reconnect with his brother that he hasn't seen so very long. But that sort of reconnection comes with risk, and when sort of long-held family strife and some secrets start to boil over, Danielle's left scared and frustrated, but, you know, the mission carries on as they try to get this man to his final resting place. It's a charming film. Like, there's this sort of relentless underlying sweetness that never really goes away, even when the narrative veers into sort of less pleasant territory. You know, these are, well, it's funny, like, you know, I don't have a huge amount of experience with Irish film, but it feels like they're almost always packed with the exact same sort of endearing oddballs that are in this movie. Of course, you have the lush and verdant backdrop. Like, you can't deny the energy of Ireland. Like, there's no mistaking it for any other place. And that energy sort of serves as the primary fuel for this movie. The director, Crehan, has a great eye for these lovely screen pictures. But also, and this is key, she manages to avoid the almost inevitable sort of stasis that you get when you have a lot of extended sort of in-vehicle sequences, because there's a lot of driving in this movie. And a lot of times that can feel very sort of still, but she does a good job of sort of making those feel kinetic. The performers are great. The actors do a great job. Heisman is basically asked to create a character who's an a-hole, but like a redeemable a-hole, and that's tough to do. Bottomley gives a good performance, although one could argue that there are some problematic issues with regards to portraying some stereotypes when it comes to autism. Algar is... you know, she plays Mary as this delightful weirdo, which is a lot of fun. And, you know, the movie's really at its best when it's these three sort of engaging with one another for good and bad. As for the supporting cast, you've got old pros like Colm Meaney and Meckleton, and, of course, Brian Cox. But again, like, it is abundantly clear that his availability was extremely limited. But they do a lot with a little. And I think that's kind of the moral to the story for this whole film. Like, it's a small movie that never really feels small. There's a very expressive spirit to it that permeates it all. We're charmed by the predictability and the unpredictability alike. It's a movie about love and loss and the ties that bind us together, whether we want them to or not.
All right, let's move on to Thunder Force.
Okay, so, like, I was already sort of, like, I have, like, and I hate to say this, like, I'm the last person in the world who ever expected to feel this way, but I feel like we might be passing the point of no return as far as, like, superhero movies are concerned. And look, lots of people would argue that we got there long ago, and I totally understand, but, like, we're talking about like we're in the immediate aftermath of the Snyder Cut, which is a 4-hour cut of a movie that was not very good in the first place that happened because fans were angry. And we've got like multiple Marvel Cinematic Universe offerings on the immediate horizon because that stuff has been piling up since theater shut down with the pandemic. Plus all the streaming series and both recent and forthcoming, drawing from all this sort of source material, both well-known and obscure. Well, it's a lot, and not all of it is good. And again, I can't stress enough, this is coming from someone who absolutely loves this stuff. So Netflix's latest foray into the realm of the superhero is Thunder Force. It's a new movie. It's written and directed by Ben Falcone, stars Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer. It's an effort to sort of play the sort of superhero tropes for laughs and have some fun with the foibles inherent to the genre. Like, and it relies very heavily on the talents of the cast to sort of carry the day. But it doesn't really work out the way they might have hoped. What always seems to be forgotten in these kinds of efforts that fall flat is that spectacle is at the forefront with superhero films. There's no denying that. But the story still matters. And if you don't have that engaging narrative, that investment, all you're left with is a bunch of CGI nonsense that it's difficult to really invest. And no matter how hard the actors are trying, they can't salvage what is ultimately an effort to turn 45 minutes or so of story into like 100 minutes of movie. The gist is, back in 1983, a burst of cosmic radiation strikes the Earth. The vast majority of the population is unaffected, but the event grants a select few superpowers. Unfortunately, one of the deciding factors with regard to who gets the powers is a tendency towards sociopathy. So the result is a world in which the only people who have superpowers are villains. They're known colloquially as miscreants, which is actually kind of a fantastic name. But their crimes are, wide-ranging and really hard to stop because of their incredible abilities. One of the victims of the collateral damage wrecked by the miscreants is this girl named Emily. She's a young lady whose geneticist parents were working on a way to sort of fight back, but they died in a train accident caused by one of those same villains. She's a brilliant, lonely kid, moves in with her grandmother, changes schools a bunch, and struggles to fit in and deals with bullies and all that sort of thing. But that all changes when she meets Lydia, who's this big-hearted bruiser of a girl who has no problem facing down anyone who she sees being a bully. Emily and Lydia become fast friends from elementary school right up to the end of high school when a fight turns them against each other and they wind up going their separate ways. Flash forward to the present, Lydia, Melissa McCarthy, works driving a forklift, but even though she's grown up, she has that same big heart and big attitude. Emily, on the other hand, has done what she set out to do. She's followed in the footsteps of her parents and become a scientist. She returns to Chicago as sort of scientific and entrepreneurial hero. Lydia and Emily have long since lost track of one another, but in an effort to reconnect, Lydia tries to get Emily to come to their high school reunion. She goes and visits the new new building that has been erected for Emily's scientific operations to sort of get her to come to the reunion. But wouldn't you know it, she starts touching stuff. She's not supposed to touch stuff. Things get weird. Specifically, Emily has apparently developed a method to give regular people superpowers in an effort to fight these villains. But thanks to Lydia, going where she's not supposed to go, Lydia becomes the first person to receive the treatment. She gets super strength. Emily gets the ability to turn invisible. She was supposed to get both, but Lydia screwed it all up. So now, with the help of Emily's daughter Tracy, played by Taylor Mosby, and a head of security named Allie, played by the wonderful Melissa Leo, Lydia and Emily basically have to learn to harness their powers to defeat the most notorious of the area's villains, a laser-powered killer named, Laser, played by Pom Clementeef. And it is all unfolding in the middle of a mayoral race led by the shipping magnate known only as the King, played by Bobby Cannavale. Rich, he might have some secrets of his own.
Oh, boy.
I guess the biggest issue I had with this movie is how disposable it is. Like, it's totally forgettable. Like, it's amusing enough in the moment. Like, it has, there are a couple of chuckles. But don't be surprised if you find yourself unable to quite remember why you were chuckling. Like, it's a comedy that just isn't that funny. And I hate to do this because I do like them both, and I think they're both very talented. But I think it's because it's the fault of the Ben Falcone, Melissa McCarthy partnership. Like I have a real affection for married partners collaborating creatively, but it feels like these two enable each other in ways that are sort of providing diminishing returns. Like they've produced a lot of work in recent years, and it just keeps getting it seems like every subsequent movie is a little worse and a little worse. And it's just like, you know what? Maybe take a little creative space from one another, like cleanse your palates before kind of trying again. Performances are fine. Like, McCarthy, I think about her turn a couple of years ago in that film. Why can't I remember the name? She's a talented actress, and she's more than pratfalls and salty language. And I really like it when she is allowed out of the box that this movie puts her in. meanwhile, Octavia Spencer spends the entire movie with this look on her face that's basically like, "I'm as surprised as you are that I'm here." You know, you would think chemistry would be the least of your concerns when you pair two talents like this, but it never quite clicks. The rest of the cast, whatever. Leo and Mosby are fine, underdeveloped. Bobby Cannavale hams it up throughout. But I do have to say, there is a highlight, and the highlight is Jason Bateman, who shows up as a villain called the Crab, and that is all I'm going to say. But he is having just a delightful time. From wearing the weird prosthetics on his arms to the frankly bizarre dance number that happens in the middle of this movie for reasons that I don't fully understand. It's the sort of movie that has the germ of an interesting idea, but all that kind of falls by the wayside in a mess of montages and shtick and non sequiturs. The sort of genre skewering movie that never quite manages to skewer anything. A movie that, all in all, just not so super.
All right, and let's wrap it up. Save this one for last because it's my girl Ginger's 10th birthday today. Tell us about a new documentary called We Don't Deserve Dogs.
Oh, man. Rich, I hesitate to recommend this movie to you because it's excellent. It's a wonderfully made documentary. It's this sort of two-person documentary partnership. A gentleman by the name of Matthew Sala and his partner Rose Tucker. They've made a number of movies. They're Australian by birth, but they live in New York City now. It's beautifully made. I cried like multiple times watching this movie. Because I love dogs. You know, I love my dog. I love every dog I ever had when I was growing up. I love dogs I pass on the street. I love dogs that bark, dogs that whine, dogs that growl. I love them all, regardless of whether or not they love me back. So obviously I'm going to be interested in a movie like this. Basically, it's a voyage around the world that looks at the various ways that dogs impact different cultures, crossing borders, different countries. All these places dogs are present. Helping us by just being the wonderful creatures that they are. So we're moving from country to country, from circumstance to circumstance, just bouncing around, encountering dogs in various environments. And even in the spots where a dog's life is difficult, like they find ways to sort of shine their light. Like it's this movie that's very heartfelt and very charming and uplifting, but also very tough to watch at times. So don't forget the tissues, because if you are anything like me, you are going to need them. Like we meet this dog named Chino. He's a street dog. He doesn't have a home. Just this absolute unit making his way in Santiago, Chile. But like he hustles and he's charismatic and he becomes this wonderful, beloved part of the lives of so many people that he encounters. And again, there's a tinge of sadness to the idea of a homeless dog, but it really seems like Chino has carved out this wonderful life for himself. You know, so you go from that to Uganda, where you basically spend all this time with a group of former child soldiers who are working with dogs in an effort to find sort of ways to deal with the traumas of their past. Like, you watch the just obvious connection between these people who are struggling to heal and, you know, and the canine companions who offer the unconditional love that helps them through that process. Like, good Lord, like, I would have been a mess anyway. But here's the thing. When you're talking about, like, you know, dogs in the wild and that sort of thing, they all look like Stella. Like, they all look like versions of my dog. And so, like, it's just like, you know, so I'm, you know, I start crying. And then it's just, and we're off to the races. And we go back and forth all over the place. Elaborate dog birthday parties. We got a woman who treats her dog like her baby. And then on the flip side, you've got, like, these celebrations of street dogs in Nepal, where there's an entire day devoted to celebrating these dogs, these animals. And then you watch as these dogs are helping soothe both people in assisted living homes and helping children who are struggling to read. Like, I mean, these same dogs are doing all these things like in a place like Finland. And you get to meet working dogs, like dogs who are seem to genuinely love what they're doing, whether they're herding sheep or hunting truffles or whatever. Like, honestly, like, everyone should be so lucky to love their jobs as much as these dogs do. And the people who work with them, they love their dogs too. It's different. I mean, it's a different kind of love, maybe, but it's love nevertheless. And I mean, I guess that's the point. Like, we're inextricably intertwined with dogs. Like, we're connected by millennia of biological and social evolution. Like, we share our lives with them, they share their lives with us. Like, it's a binding tie that, again, means different things to different people and cultures, but that is inevitably present. Again, I can't stress enough, it's a beautifully shot and produced piece of filmmaking. Like, and these two are, they're basically a two-man band. Like, they're each wearing multiple hats to bring this movie to life. And it just, and that's the thing, this movie just overflows with life. It's lush, there's a visual acuity that captures all these natural and urban landscapes. Like, it's lovely to look at. And it has these really striking images to go along with the sort of joys of the subject. And I should note, because I think this is important information. No time is spent in the United States. Dog culture here is prevalent and pervasive, but by eschewing that coverage, like, they can be more expansive in their exploration of the world's sort of relationship with dogs. And again, in case it isn't clear, I'm a soft touch when it comes to this sort of thing. So that dynamic almost always impacts me emotionally. And it's, you know, it's rendered maybe even more effective just by the fact that it's all real. It's all true.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, shedding tears during multiple segments. They just do a wonderful job capturing the affection and connection expressed by people to their dogs. Some of it's silly, some of it's sad, some of it's sweet, but it's all real. And that reality is what really sort of impacts me. Look, ultimately, and I think I'm pretty sure you're in agreement with me on this, the titular assertion is accurate. Like, we don't deserve dogs.
No.
Even as they continue to show up for us. And if you are of that mindset, then you are 100% the target audience for this film. Just a delight.
I'll be watching by myself with a big box of tissues.
Oh, yeah. Just crying, and you'll be like, and then you'll stop for a bit, and then something else, and it'll be like, oh, yep, nope, there's more. I've got more.
I mean, I'm going home so we can have a birthday party for Ginger.
Oh, and Stella says happy birthday,
Bob. Oh, I will pass that along. She'll be very happy to hear that. Alan, we thank you as always and appreciate you stopping by. Let's do it again come Wednesday.
Sounds good to me, man.
All right, we'll see you then. Alan Adams of The Main Edge talking movies on Pass the Popcorn.